Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Debate over term limits for some Florida judges turns into a larger discussion about the judiciary in the Florida House.
You know, Brown versus Board of Education was called judicial activism. Anyone still think integrating our schools was judicial activism? Anyone still hold that opinion?
Also tonight, the House had a busy day on the floor and they opened session by cutting a blank check for the governor's economic development program.
Vote for it today and you'll find out later what it's going to cost you. Is that the way we do business? Is that fiscal conservatism?
We'll also catch up on a plan to expand the Florida cabinet, the status of state worker retirement, and a move to make the state's roads safer for those not driving in cars. I'm Tom Flanagan on day three of week seven of the Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. The recent death of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has added a new dimension to a legislative debate over term limits for Florida justices and appellate judges. The House approved a measure today despite dire warnings by Democrats and little interest in the Senate.
Unlike their brethren on the U.S. Supreme Court, Florida's seven justices aren't appointed for life. Florida law forces them to retire at 70. And three of them will reach so-called constitutional senility in 2019. But nobody would know it listening to Wednesday's House floor debate. Some conservative Republicans argued Florida's justices and appellate judges are too entrenched and should be shown the door after just 12 years. Here's Republican Jennifer Sullivan of Eustis.
In our executive branch, we have a check and balance of term limits. In the legislative branch, we have a check and balance system of term limits. But however, this third branch, this judicial branch, doesn't have that check and balance system.
Republican John Wood of Winter Haven is sponsoring an amendment on the November ballot that would force justices and appellate judges to step down after serving 2 6-year terms. Wood is considered a constitutional scholar, and this is his official reason for the legislation.
The motivation behind this is the love of the Constitution.
However, Wood was a bitter critic of last year's Florida Supreme Court decision striking down the legislature's congressional redistricting plan, and that wasn't lost on Democrats. They spent most of the debate suggesting Wood was out for revenge. Representative Evan Jenny of Hollywood suggested Republicans are acting like members of a losing football team.
I'm of the belief that your first response should be to practice more, to train more, perhaps even develop better techniques. What you shouldn't do is complain about the referees and demand new ones.
Democrat Jose Rodriguez of Miami was more blunt.
You really have to wonder what this is about. And for many of us, the conclusion we've reached is that this has a flavor of retribution.
Wood denies wanting to get even. He reminds his critic the bill doesn't apply to sitting judges and justices. Some supporters say judges would be more responsive to the people they serve. And others say the stodgiest branch of government would be constantly infused with new blood. Here's Republican Representative Larry Metz, an attorney from Yalaha.
I think it would actually open up opportunities for the best and brightest of our trial judges to serve upline.
But critics warn term limits would strip the judiciary of institutional knowledge. Some said lawyers would be less willing to serve on the bench, knowing they would have to return to private practice in midlife. Another South Florida Democrat, Jared Moskowitz of Coral Springs, used the debate to strike back at Republican leaders in the U.S. Senate. Moskowitz disagrees with their decision not to let President Barack Obama fill a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. He offered an amendment that would ban lame duck governors from doing the same.
If you agree with Mitch McConnell that a president should not be able to fulfill his constitutional duty, then you should also agree that a governor should not be able to fill his constitutional duty.
Moskowitz had 30 amendments filed at one time, but they were either defeated or withdrawn. before the final vote Wednesday, he had harsh words for conservatives complaining about judicial activism.
You know, Brown versus Board of Education was called judicial activism. Anyone still think integrating our schools was judicial activism? Anyone still hold that opinion?
The House approved the measure 76-38, but the Senate companion has yet to get a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
House lawmakers took up a raft of legislation for the final vote today. Nick Evans has more about what happened on that chamber's floor.
The House plodded off to a sluggish, contentious start again Wednesday, kicking things off with an economic development package sponsored by Bradenton Republican Jim Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members, this is the bill that we discussed yesterday that adds transparency and accountability to the job-creating process in Florida.
Transparency is an interesting word, right? Boyd's measure has raised hackles among some in the chamber because its fiscal impact is a great big question mark. While the Senate is agreeing to go along with the governor's $250 million ask, the House is leaving the dollar figure off, allowing leadership to work out the cost in the budget conference. Here's Coconut Creek Democrat Kristen Jacobs.
What is the cost of this bill? Can anybody tell me? Because it's sitting right here on my desk with a big fat zero attached to it. When do we take bills up here and we don't know what we're going to spend? We're going to wait. We're going to vote for it today. Vote for it today, and you'll find out later what it's going to cost you. Is that the way we do business? Is that fiscal conservatism? I think not. I think that it is a scary road that we are heading down.
But as it happens, $250 million is a lot of money. And if lawmakers can roll it into the budget vote rather than explicitly approving the expenditure, for many, it looks like a win-win. The dollars can be spun into a victory for small businesses at home in the district, while those fiscal conservative principles remain safe from attack. A number of Democrats, primarily from the Black Caucus, jumped ship to join the GOP majority in favor of the measure.
Members, the question now recurs on final passage of CS for HB 1325. The clerk will unlock the machine. The members will proceed to vote.
But almost 30 Republicans voted against it.
79 yeas, 39 nays, Mr. Speaker.
Show the bill passes. Read the next.
Later on the floor, lawmakers took up a measure that would launch pilot programs aimed at making it easier to find missing persons with special needs. Here's the bill's sponsor, Lake City Republican Elizabeth Porter.
Just as a little background on this, in August of 2014, a young boy by the name of Leo Walker climbed out of his bedroom window and wandered off from his home in Live Oak, Florida. Walker, who had autism spectrum disorder, was found about 1,000 feet away from his home in a small pond.
Porter explains even though they came quickly, first responders weren't able to rescue Walker. The search cost local law enforcement agencies almost $1 million. Porter's bill, on the other hand, appropriates $100,000 to develop and provide personal tracking devices to assist in search and rescue efforts.
So members, the cost of this pilot program is significantly less than the cost of one search and rescue operation for an autistic child. It's time for us to be proactive rather than reactive, because that's how we can save lives, and I would appreciate
a similar measure died in the Senate last year, but this time around it's already passed. Now it's on its way to the governor. The House also took up and passed a measure related to elder guardianship. Seminole Republican Larry Ahern shares the story of Marie Winkleman shortly before the vote.
At the last accounting of her checking account, it had been docked some $635,000 to pay the guardian, attorney, and others involved in her case. Members, a yes vote today begins the process that says Florida is providing the protection necessary to end any impropriety associated with the guardianship program.
The Senate already approved that measure as well. The rest of the week is taken up with committee hearings. The House will reconvene on the floor again next week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, some lawmakers say a four-person Florida cabinet doesn't make sense. They're pushing to make the Secretary of State cabinet member number five.
Four is indeed a very odd number, should it be the number of your cabinet officers.
The Florida House has given its stamp of approval to a state worker pension reform package, but critics say it contains a controversial part.
This bill here does a lot of bad things to some good people.
Should Florida's roads be safe only for those driving cars and trucks?
Bottom line, Florida was developed in the age of the automobile. And unlike New York City, Boston, or other cities or states, we don't have a history and we don't have a pattern of development that's based around pedestrians.
And we'll celebrate the lyrical beauty of the Romance languages, Spanish, French, Latin, and coding?
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Florida's Secretary of State is appointed to his position by the governor, but Regan McCarthy reports that hasn't always been the case, and now some lawmakers are pushing to return the state's elections chief to an elected position.
The Florida Secretary of State oversees the state's elections as well as business registration, and he also promotes the state's arts, culture, and history. And Fernandina Beach Republican Representative Aaron Bean says when voters approved a move in 2003 to make the position an appointed rather than elected one, it was a mistake.
We all know that four is an even number. Unless four is the total number of your board of directors, your committee roster, or your cabinet. Four is indeed a very odd number, should it be the number of your cabinet officers.
Currently, the cabinet is made up of the governor, the attorney general, the chief financial officer, and the agriculture commissioner. Bean says it doesn't make sense for a decision-making body, especially the Florida cabinet, to be made up of an even number of people. He says that leads to complications when it comes to tied votes.
The governor has a super vote, and maybe the governor should have a super vote, but I just think traditionally I want what's best. I want people all debate, and I want the majority to rule in those cabinet discussions.
Bean is pushing a bill to change the state's constitution, making the Secretary of State an elected position and a member of the cabinet again. But some, like Tampa Democratic Senator Arthenia Joyner, asked Bean whether he would consider getting to that odd number of cabinet members by making the education secretary an elected position instead.
That person should be accountable to the people for the education policy because
it is such a critical function.
It's a critical function of government, and I don't want it dictated by one person who happens to be the governor. I just think that that person should be someone that focused on education.
But Bean says he thinks it's important for the chief election supervisor to answer directly to the people.
I believe strongly that we need a supervisor of elections, our chief supervisor elections officer, directly accountable to the people. You know, when you're accountable to the people, your whole perspective changes. We're going to see a Secretary of State, not that there's anything wrong with our current Secretary of State, but travel and speak to civic clubs and be out there, be on the trail.
And Orlando Democratic Senator Darren Soto agrees.
Over the past couple of years, we saw attempts at voter purges. We saw a hostility towards online registration. And I think that if it was an elected Secretary of State, we'd see them be more amenable to a lot of these moves that we've seen before that were, frankly, not popular, not supported by the general public.
Meanwhile, the current Secretary of State, Ken Detzner, who has been making his way through the confirmation process this year in order to keep his appointed position, has been peppered with questions about Bean's bill. And he says he has some experience with the matter.
As you may know, I was the secretary back in 2002, and I was the first appointed secretary. So I helped transition the department between an elected office and an appointed office. And you know what? I'll tell you, my view is the bottom line is, as an appointee, it really makes a difference who appoints you and what flexibility, what leadership that they encourage from you.
Detzner says he's neutral on the issue, but does say he thinks an elected Secretary of State will be subject to more political pressure than he faces as an appointed officer now. The measure passed in the Senate Rules Committee Wednesday. Its next stop is the chamber's floor, but the measure doesn't appear to be moving in the House. Meanwhile, another bill, sponsored by Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia, would make the Commissioner of Education an elected position. That bill's next stop is the Senate Rules Committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The Florida House passed a controversial bill making changes to Florida's retirement system, and we get that story from Sasha Cordner.
North Fort Myers Republican Representative Matt Caldwell says he's very proud of this latest effort to reform the Florida retirement system.
If you retired during the economic recession and cashed out of your investments because you felt like that was the best choice, and now you want to come back and try to work for the state, you can't get back into the investment plan. We're changing that. If you are a first responder or any other kind of employee and you chose to go into the investment plan and you die in the line of duty, you're not going to be punished for that decision anymore. You're going to get the same death benefit as you would have if you had chosen the pension from the very beginning.
Both those changes in the House pension reform bill have widespread bipartisan support. The controversial provision that most Democrats and public employee unions say they can't get behind changes the default retirement option for new hires within the system. The traditional pension plan is the current default and the more popular retirement option. Caldwell's bill changes that to the 401k-style option known as the investment plan. While she says there are good parts to the bill, Tallahassee Democratic Representative Michelle Rewinkle-Vasalinda is against the measure.
A policy decision to in any way start eroding the state pension system, which I think this bill does, even though it's one of the mildest bills I've seen in the past 8 years, I think is a step in the wrong direction.
But Delray Beach Republican Representative Bill Hager disagrees.
I served a number of years with the American Academy of Actuaries. I've had as many as 150 actuaries under my employ. Everything in this bill adds stability to our retirement system, and nothing takes away stability in this system. This is good policy, good public policy, and it's good for our law enforcement professionals.
Orlando Republican Representative Renee Plasencia took a different tack. He says he can't believe anyone would be against a bill that includes death benefits for the surviving spouses of law enforcement. During Wednesday's House session, he reminded lawmakers that the bill stems from the former Orange County Deputy Scott Pine, who lost his life while on duty 2 years ago. Pine had chosen the investment plan, which doesn't really provide benefits, and Plasencia says Pine's family has since been struggling.
Deputy Pine's family do not understand, nor do they care about the political implications surrounding this bill. Default language means nothing to them. They lost a husband, a father, and a best friend. I implore all of us to consider the sacrifices that have been made by so many families like the Pines who are looking towards us to do the right thing.
And the House measure passed 72-38 with some Republicans joining Democrats in opposition. And House Speaker Steve Crisafulli says he's hopeful the Senate will take up its pension reform package too.
So we believe this bill is far more acceptable than things that we've sent over there in the past from the standpoint of being acceptable to the Senate. And I would hope that they'd look at it seriously and potentially take it up.
But the Senate recently voted unanimously on a standalone bill granting death benefits to surviving spouses. And the Senate bill sponsor, Margate Democrat Jeremy Ring, says he hopes the House will not try to negotiate and take up the Senate bill instead. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Some state lawmakers want to make Florida's roads safer, especially for those not traveling in cars. The bill would offer special protections to cyclists and pedestrians, but one group is being left out: motorcyclists. Kate Payne has that story.
According to the CDC, Florida has the highest rate of cyclist deaths in the nation, double the national average. Advocates point to speed limits, road width, and lack of awareness. But cycling activist Mike Lachey says Florida's roads were simply built for cars, not people.
Why is this happening? Bottom line, Florida was developed in the age of the automobile. And unlike New York City, Boston, or other cities or states, we don't have a history and we don't have a pattern of development that's based around pedestrians.
Lawmakers can't go back in time, but they do want to make roads safer for so-called vulnerable users. Cape Canaveral Senator Thad Altman's bill would increase penalties for motorists when cyclists or pedestrians are injured in car accidents. Here's his legislative aide, Devin West.
The bill revises and creates various statutory provisions and penalties relating to traffic control laws and vulnerable users, such as pedestrians and bicyclists. It clarifies provisions relating to overtaking and passing vulnerable users, particularly with respect to maintaining the required distance between a passing vehicle and a vulnerable user.
But because of an amendment filed by Lake Worth Senator Jeff Clemens, there is one group that would not be covered by these protections, motorcyclists. Here's Senator Clemens.
If you go back and you look through those particular categories that are included here, we're talking about wheelchairs. We're talking about a horse-drawn carriage. We're talking about a farm tractor. All those things share things in common with bicycles, with pedestrians. The outlier here is motorcycle.
As could be expected, some bikers don't appreciate this. Doc Reichenbach is the president of motorcycle group Abate Florida.
But I love my motorcycle. It takes less wear and tear on the road, less fossil fuel. And it's very nice. But I can't tell you how many times the people have come up on my rear bumper of my motorcycle or my rear fender and literally try to push me forward.
Reichenbach says people on motorcycles should be protected just like people on bicycles.
So to say we're not vulnerable is not true. I go to too many funerals.
Back in 2000, Reichenbach's group led a push to do away with helmet requirements for motorcyclists. After the law was repealed, helmet use plummeted and the death toll shot up. So when it comes to safety, Clemens argues, you can't have it both ways.
Motorcyclists fought to not have to wear safety protection. Now they're fighting to be included as a special category under the law that has special consequences. And, in my opinion, I just don't think that they belong there any more than a convertible vehicle or a smart car does.
The Senate Fiscal Policy Committee passed the bill Wednesday. The measure is now ready for a floor vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A bill that would give some juvenile offenders a break is moving in the Senate, but as Ashley Tressel reports, not everyone thinks it's a good idea.
Misdemeanors like petty theft, riots, and marijuana possession would no longer warrant an arrest. Instead, officers would be required to issue a civil citation if it's a first-time offense. Battery is also on that list, as long as the victim approves. Bill sponsor Senator Thad Altman says he wants to keep kids from getting criminal records.
What we're trying to do is to keep kids out of the system. We're trying to make that first encounter with law enforcement one that's not quite as negative and ominous as a lifetime arrest record.
After opposition from law enforcement groups, Altman added an amendment to change the age cutoff from 17 to 15, but critics still aren't happy. Frank Fabrizio of the Florida Police Chiefs Association says some things can't be solved with a civil citation.
Okay, we go to a large fight, a fray, riot. We go to that out there. How is that quelling that situation right then? We're going to give them a civil citation and walk away? There are instances where we have to make an arrest.
Barney Bishop of the Florida Smart Justice Alliance is also opposed. He says the bill allows kids to walk all over law enforcement.
These kids will know right away what this means. This means that they can sit there, they can shoot a bird, they can tell the officer to go F themselves, and that officer has to give them a civil citation? Are you kidding me? This is wrong.
Others are concerned because there's no civil citation record. Sarah Carroll, a lobbyist for the Florida Sheriff's Association, says juveniles could avoid being arrested for a second offense by going to a different county. But Meredith Stanfield of the Department of Juvenile Justice says a citation database will be available in the spring. A similar bill in the House passed its first committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ashley Tressel.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Democratic Senator Jeremy Ring is determined to get coding before more Florida public school students. His plan is nearing final passage in the Senate, and the debate over the bill could soon turn to the House, as we hear from Lynn Hatter.
It's not what Margate Democrat Jeremy Ring is trying to do. Most people, including fellow Democratic Senator Jeff Clemens, say getting more kids to learn coding is a good thing. But Clemens is concerned about how Ring is going about doing it.
For some things, when you get past Algebra 1, Algebra 2, geometry, the vast majority of our society is not going to use those skills. Having said that, I understand that there's probably no chance this amendment is going to pass here today, but I was looking for an alternative because I do understand what Senator Ring is trying to accomplish here. I just have a disagreement with how he's accomplishing it.
The issue, whether coding should substitute for a foreign language over a higher level math, has generated some of the most heated debate over the bill. Early on, Linda Markley with the Florida Foreign Language Association spoke out against it.
Coding is not the same as world languages. Even coding.org, which is the National Organization for Computer Coding, does not agree with this trend, and they do not support it. They state that computer coding is to computer science as spelling is to writing poetry.
Markley cited a two-year-old blog post on code.org, and while it may be a stretch to say the organization does not support the idea, blog author and policy director Amy Hirataka argued while coding is a language of sorts, it's more of a math or science. She writes code is more a tool to interact with computers to make ideas come to life. Several states are pushing bills like Florida's. Some do allow coding to substitute for a higher level math, like trigonometry or calculus. And Ring argues,
whatever profession we choose politics, we choose construction, we choose law, we can choose medicine, we can choose media, we can choose anything. If you don't have certain technology skills, you will be left behind today. It's a basic skill.
Changes to the bill allow schools to choose whether to offer coding, and there are other questions, like how districts would carry out such a plan. The original version of the bill would have required districts to implement a coding course, but an amendment by Republican Senator Bill Galvano now makes it optional for districts to offer coding. And it allows students to use the Florida Virtual School to meet the requirement. Miami Democrat Dwight Bullard asks how some students would access coding, especially in poor or rural districts that may not have enough devices and still have to meet other state technology requirements.
When you already have limited access to computers, is what I'm referring to is how do you then conceptualize teaching a course when you know that several weeks out the year, access to those laboratories, access to those computers, that coding would necessitate.
Parents would have to sign a waiver stating they understand coding may not count at an out-of-state school. And Senate Minority Leader Arthenia Joyner says there's nothing wrong with offering kids an option.
Which will it be? Will I take coding or will I take the foreign language? And I think it's fine to have an option. We have options every day.
Furthermore, Republican Senator Aaron Bean says he took about 4 years of Spanish between high school and college.
Let me tell you about a blow-off class I took in high school that I use every day. Keyboarding, typing, how about that? It was supposed to be a blow-off class for me, but it's a skill that has been proven to be invaluable.
Though, as Senate President Andy Gardner noted, Bean's Spanish teacher may not have been too happy about those comments. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Ashley Tressel and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.